From Greenwich to Danbury, Wilton to Westport, Fairfield County Talk Radio is here to help serve the community.
Welcome. Hello, I'm Lisa Wexler. We're broadcast from the great, the one and only Orem's Diner here on Route 33 in Wilton. And you are listening to the monthly Cup of Joe political show, which takes place live from 8 to 9 p.m. on, is it the second or third Tuesday of the month, if you think I can keep count? You believe it's the second. That's good. On the second Tuesday of the month. And so we are here in the beautiful month of May, although it's hard to know that with 44 degrees outside. And this program this morning is sponsored by a host of wonderful local businesses, including Georgetown Orthodontics, which has offices in Reading and Norwalk, the Wilton Chamber of Commerce, Art and Builders, Forward Thinking Multidiscipline Construction, and you can download the Fairfield County Radio app on iTunes through the App Store at Fairfield County Talk. I'm Lisa Wexler, and this morning I am delighted to introduce you to our new state senator, Will Haskell, representing the 26th District, which is about seven towns, right, Will?
That's right. Thanks so much for having me, Lisa. I have the honor of representing in Westport, Wilton, Weston, Ridgefield, Reading, Bethel, New Canaan, or some portion of those towns.
Fantastic
anyways.
District.
It really is.
I must say.
It's a puzzle piece of a district, but I have, I happen to think I have the best constituents.
Naturally. I would think, because I live in Westport, I'm here in Wilton, I would hope so. So, first of all, Will, what's it like for you? You're a freshman senator. You stepped into the shoes of Tony Boucher, who was well-known in local government for a long time. How has it, generally speaking, been for you up in Hartford?
First of all, I should say that they're big shoes to fill, and my experience over the last few months has only given me more respect for what Senator Boucher did for many years. It's a long drive to Hartford. It's in some ways a thankless job. I mean, we regularly go until midnight with late night votes.
And it's not very well paid for those of you who don't know. What,
no.
What is your salary?
I think the state senator's salary is around $29,000. We all have to have a second job, which poses some real scheduling challenges when you're
and there. Conflict of interest ones.
That's true. I was pretty careful to avoid a job that that would in any way pose a conflict of interest. But some of my colleagues are a little less scrupulous, I have to say.
And you
think? That worries
yeah.
me. But we should have that conversation another time.
We do have that once in a while, yes, more than once in a while on the show. But how have you, so with newfound respect for the haul that it is to get to Hartford, let us know, what is the general schedule of the legislature? Is it an all-year job?
I'm really glad you asked that, because a lot of people don't realize. The timeline is very quick. You know, I was sworn in the first week of January, at which point I had 14 days to propose any bills that I wanted to introduce. That's really not a lot of time.
At all.
So, you know, that was a period where I put my head down, got to work, tried to figure out how to translate all of the ideas that we talked about when we went door to door, that we talked about in living rooms, the constituents came to me with. I remember scrolling through old emails, trying to find little snippets of ideas that people had sent me along the way. And how to translate those into actual real legislation. It was a real challenge, and it was a two-week crunch. Then the process was committee hearings where the public was invited to testify. It slowed down a little bit. We stayed really late listening to people, but there was less to there was less of a deadline. Now that all those bills, around, I don't know, a few thousand bills, made it out of committee, we have to pass those bills on the House floor and the
or
Senate
not.
Floor. Or not. And the case with most bills is not.
Well, yeah. I mean, how many new laws do we need every year?
Right. The vast majority of things die. But there are some really important issues that I'm getting worried might fall by the wayside. For instance, I ran my campaign on paid family leave, common sense gun violence prevention, and some of those votes have been called in the House but not the Senate. Some of those votes have been called in the Senate but not the House.
Explain. Just stop right there when
sure.
you say called in. What's the power behind the throne? What's that process about?
So the leadership decides what's going to get a vote every day. And for instance, I'm on my way up to Hartford right after this show, and we'll sit together in our caucus rooms, and we'll be told basically what we're voting on that afternoon.
And who decides it? The chairman of the committee? Or
it's even higher than that? It's a conversation between the chairman of the committee, the Senate majority leader, and the Senate president, as well as, of course, the minority leader. And so Republicans and Democrats get together, leadership on both sides of the aisle, and they decide what gets a vote. It's now my job to really lobby pretty heavily for a vote on the things I care most about.
Oh.
Some of those issues that I talked about, given the fact, and this goes back to your original question, the deadline for just about everything, for everything really, is June 5th. On June 5th, if your bill hasn't been called for a vote, it is dead. The legislature goes home. So we are now around, I think we have 17 days in the Capitol left, and a lot to do, from tolls to, like I said, paid family leave to, by the way, passing a budget, which is probably our most fundamental job.
The big one.
We've got our
work
cut out
for us. Where
the devil
is in the details.
Oh, God. That's for sure.
And speaking of budget, before we get waylaid with a lot of other important things, my other hat that I wear is as the probate judge of the Westport Weston District, both towns of which are in your district. And one of the things that I do is try and educate all legislators, new and experienced, about the importance of keeping our probate system and keeping it working well. Because not only does it do, I think, in general, an extraordinary job of accessible courts to the vast majority of people who are not represented by counsel, and to aid the most vulnerable people that are have mental illness, that are intellectually disabled, that have advanced stages of dementia. That's over half of what we do. But also saves the taxpayers a tremendous amount of money, because we do it virtually on a shoestring budget. The vast majority of probate courts, of which there are 54, occupy spaces in town halls. They've done that forever because we're the oldest court system in Connecticut. And we had a deal in 2011, before your time, Will, where when there was an initial consolidation from over 100 probate courts to 54, there was a deal made that the probate fees, the fees that are generated by what we do that are paid directly by the public, would comprise 2/3 of our budget, and the other 1/3 would be made up by the legislature in return for a lot of things that happened at that time and that have continued to happen. And there's no question that probate administration manages, and individually our courts manage our budget. If you ever came to my court, you'd see we write on backs of pieces of paper.
Oh, I've seen some of the amazing work that you guys do.
But we're also very efficient about it. Like no kidding, there's no fluff. And our clerks have not had a raise in 5 years. Not one raise in 5 years. And the average starting probate clerk now, which has to be done by a really smart person, is $16 an hour.
Wow.
And I need somebody for our court with paralegal or legal training. Not easy to find. And the healthcare benefits keep going up as a percentage of somebody's salary. So the good news for us is that probate court administration asked for an appropriation that was met by the Appropriations Committee. But the governor's budget proposes something vastly lower. And I'm asking for your support, Will, on behalf of our system, to go with what the appropriations budget came out of in your process, to stick with it in a final budget.
Well, I absolutely promise that I'm going to keep fighting for the probate court system. Having had the pleasure of visiting your office in Westport's Town Hall and met with actually a lot of other probate judges in my district, the work that you guys do, some people don't realize, but when you're in probate
court... Well, there aren't a lot of other probate... Oh, in your district.
In my
district,
yeah.
Of course there are.
Yeah, but
that's
Canaan,
right. And Doug just got elected to Wilton Norwalk.
Exactly.
Right.
When folks come to your courthouse, it's a time in their life where they are perhaps most vulnerable. It is...
And grief.
Right. It is elderly folks who are suffering. It's children who don't know where else to turn.
That's right.
The work that you guys do is so so fundamentally important to building a fair and compassionate society that we absolutely need to be sending more money into the system. And just to give you an idea of some of the wheeling and dealing or the trading that happens up in Hartford, I went up there with having heard from my constituents that they want to get rid of the estate tax. And I happen to agree with them. While I support an estate tax on a national level, I believe in the redistribution of wealth between generations, I think it puts Connecticut at an economic disadvantage to have a state-level estate tax, which essentially drives high earners out of the state. However, what I quickly found out was the estate tax actually fully funds the probate court system. That's how...
That's a big piece of it.
That's the mechanism through which they do it.
And this is something I think most people need to be aware of. It is such a tiny minority of people that pay it. Even
right.
when it was at the 2 million, now it right. is much more. Now it's 3.5 and it's moving up to 5 very quickly. People think that because we live in an affluent society, most people end up paying an estate tax. But when you're married, It's a complete spousal deduction. So on the, quote, first to die, there's no estate tax. And then very often by the second to die, people have spent down their earnings by the time they live. It's such, if I showed you, I would love to have the statistics in front of me, the amount of people who pass away in the state versus the amount of people who end up owing an estate tax, it's tiny.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in an ideal world, I would still like to get rid of the estate tax.
Okay.
If nothing else, for a messaging point of view.
I understand that.
But you're exactly right that we need to get the information out to folks that many people aren't paying this. It's a small minority of really wealthy folks. And what we were able to afford in the budget that came out of the Finance Committee is an elimination of the gift tax.
Which I think we should have done. We were the only state out of 50 that still had one.
And by the way, we're
the
one of...
The only state.
Right, right. So this, it's a no-brainer. It doesn't bring in much money. That's one that we can afford.
I'm glad we did that.
We got rid of that pesky business entity tax, that
$250. Oh, really? It's gone?
It's gone according to the Finance Committee budget. We've got to pass the budget now by both
chambers.
That's
another thing that makes us less competitive than others when it comes to starting corporations.
That's exactly right. So we're trying to remove those pesky taxes that create a business-unfriendly environment.
So let's talk about that, because in the original governor's budget, there were things like vet bills, taxing legal bills, creating swarms of people that would have to pay sales tax on services, hairdressers. So where did we end up with that, Will Haskell?
I'm glad you mentioned this. I heard from an amazing number of constituents, whether they own a travel service here in travel agency here in Wilton, whether they're an interior designer, architect. God knows I heard from a lot of lawyers. Both my parents are lawyers. The sales tax is, as you know, 6.35% applied to a wide variety of industries, but some are carved out. For lawyers, they're carved out because we want to make sure that everybody can afford counsel. For other industries, it might be carved out because they had a really effective lobbyist. And that's sort of an interesting thing. So because something hasn't been taxed in the past, people believe there's this God-given exemption to their industry. And I'm not sure. The governor pushed back on that. But frankly, the legislature didn't seem to have much of an appetite for expanding the sales tax to some crucial industries. I certainly had hesitations the sales tax
to
lawyers.
I'll tell you why. Well, and lawyers is always an issue because then you have to disclose your clients.
Right.
And that's another problem. But the other issue for people like architects or vets is it tends to be still people that are in relatively small businesses paying a sales tax. I don't know if you've ever been in business yourself. But I've certainly had a lot of clients. It's an infrastructure that's costly. Mm-hmm. It's a costly administrative infrastructure. And I think that's the pushback.
Right. And I understood that pushback. Frankly, I was part of it in the legislature trying to urge my colleagues not to expand it to so many industries. And here's where we successfully ended up out of the Finance Committee. The sales tax of 6.35% will be expanded to interior design services, parking services, transportation companies, and non-coin operated dry cleaning. I haven't heard from too many constituents complaining about this, so I think that this is
those poor interior designers, where are they? They need to lobby.
They may need to lobby, but the process is obviously far from over. But I think that it's a far more moderate expansion of the sales tax rather than the broad brush approach that the governor's budget had.
We're chatting with Senator Will Haskell. You're listening to the Lisa Wexler Show. So, Will, can we talk about vaccinations for a minute?
Oh, I would love to.
Because the measles, which was officially eradicated around the year 2000, has now made a resurgence in numbers we haven't seen since 1994. And a lot of that is because the MMR vaccine created a lot of controversy because people thought that it contributed to autism, even though the original Lansing article that said that, the person who wrote it ended up being the equivalent of disbarred in England. He was excommunicated from the medical profession. And there was recently a study of 600,000 people over a long period of time in Scandinavia that showed that the people that took the MMR vaccine actually had a slightly less statistical probability of developing autism, like 6 or 7% less. And the reality is, for me, that vaccinations are the single greatest public health success we've ever had as humankind.
Hey, how are you?
So with that, and the fact that in Rockland County, there was an outbreak such that the Rockland County executive, even though he knew it probably wasn't legal, banned people from the public square if they hadn't been vaccinated. Bill de Blasio stood in Brooklyn and tried to do the same thing. What is your personal view on vaccinations, and how does that translate to you as a legislator?
Well, first of all, I'm so grateful that you're bringing this information and this point of view on air. It's not just a reality for you that vaccines are the greatest public health cure that we've seen over the in the 20th and 21st century. It's the reality for everybody. You know, I was having this conversation with my grandparents over dinner last night, and I was amazed at how worked up they got about it. Then I realized, you know what? They lived through the polio crisis.
My mother had to be sent home from camp in the 1940s because of a polio outbreak. She's talked about that her whole life.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. See, for older generations, they just can't believe that we are turning away this incredible opportunity to be safe and secure and healthy, an opportunity which they and so many of their peers did not have
did not
when they
have.
Grew up in the
Jonas
early 20th
Salk
century.
Was a hero.
That's exactly right. So, you know, this we're having this conversation up in the state capitol and frankly probably in diners across Connecticut because the Department of Public Health in Connecticut released data that showed 108 schools fall below the recommended 95% immunization rate. That's a 95% recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that provides herd immunity. So it doesn't just protect those students who are vaccinated. It also protects everybody else by making sure that those diseases, those measles, mumps, and rubella don't sneak their way into the kindergarten classroom. People were shocked that in tiny Connecticut with 169 towns, there are 108 schools that fall below that necessary rate. And we started to look at why that is. And it's because there are two ways that you can avoid vaccinations in Connecticut if you decide to enroll in school. You can either claim a medical exemption or a religious exemption. Now, the medical exemption is difficult to get. It's a pretty high bar set by the medical community. And we should, by the way, have a conversation about making sure if there is a real medical issue concerning a child's compromised immune system, that they are able to get that medical exemption. But
exemption or even delay.
Sure, absolutely. But what we've discovered instead is that there are a large number of families who claim a religious exemption without any theological grounding to do so. There was a long hearing on this in Hartford yesterday, and there were actually quite a few religious leaders who came and said, there was a rabbi, I believe he was from the Stanford area. He said, I believe there's a scriptural calling to vaccinate, to make sure that your kids are safe. He said, I don't in any way want people to misconstrue what's happening in Brooklyn in a certain
it's
Orthodox
terrible.
Community to be in any way
reflective of the Jewish attitude toward this, not to mention the fact that Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin, who came up with the liquid polio vaccine, were both Jews.
That's exactly right. And it's not the job of Hartford to play a legislator to play theologian. I'm not here to say that anybody's religious exemption is invalid, but we see high levels of religious exemptions being claimed even in Catholic schools across Connecticut when there is no Catholic objection. So it's clearly being abused by some as a means of avoiding something that the scientific community overwhelmingly supports, and that's vaccinating your children.
So, do you think that there is a almost superstitious fear going on? What are these families thinking? Have you had any of them testify before you in Hartford as to why they don't want to vaccinate their kids?
Oh my gosh, I have sat down with so many of these families, and I should say that I am sympathetic. I've met their children, some of whom suffer from autism. I've met with parents who believe that if they vaccinate their child, they are going to harm their child. And I can't imagine the anguish they're going through. But the problem is their position is simply not supported by scientific fact or the consensus of the medical community. That's why we're having a really serious conversation about getting rid of the religious exemption. If you don't want to vaccinate your children, that's your right. I wish you would, but if you want to go to the park and raise them as you wish, I think that your religious freedom enshrined in our Constitution protects that. But if you're going to send your child to school and put
well, you
other,
have to,
right?
Don't you?
Well, you could homeschool your child.
Yes. So are you saying that then homeschool children will end up not having to be vaccinated in this new?
Well, the current law, as I understand it, says you don't have to vaccinate if you're homeschooled.
Oh, okay.
But if
and that's not up for change.
No. The only thing that's up for change is if you're going to send your child into the classroom, if you're going to put other kids at risk, that's where your religious freedom and liberty, I think, comes to a halt. Right? I mean, if my religion were to put others in harm's way, law enforcement officers would rightly intercede and say, you know what? Your religious freedom doesn't give you the right to endanger others. The classroom is, in my mind, a sacrosanct place. Every student and every parent should have the ability to feel safe and healthy in that space.
So, you know, it's interesting because as a lawyer, I come at this with a constitutional framework, and there's always been an analysis constitutionally of an accommodation. So it's always in other words, if somebody wants to wear a headscarf and an employer can accommodate that, then they have to do so. right? Because then religious freedom would trump that. But if the headscarf is something that might get caught in a machine on an assembly line, then maybe they can't wear the headscarf for that job. Maybe the employer has to find another job for them, but not that. But so the question becomes, in a similar vein to the right of free exercise of religion versus what is the public's right to being free from mumps, measles, rubella? And where does that collide? My own view, is that a religious exemption for a vaccination is not a, it's not supportable. My own view. That's my own opinion.
And by the way, there are many other states that have gotten rid of the religious exemption. And the Attorney General of Connecticut, William Tong, issued an opinion that said the Constitution does not protect a religious exemption for vaccines for students in public school. It's the very same reason.
Oh, so it's students in public school. So
and,
if they
and
go
private, both.
Private as well.
Yeah. It's the same reason that you and I fight for common sense gun violence prevention. Every student has a right to feel safe in the classroom. And that means they ought to feel healthy. It means they ought to feel safe from a potential school shooter. It means they ought to feel safe against bullying and cyber harassment. We want to make sure that school is a protected place.
All right. So, Senator Will Haskell, you're listening to the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back.
Look outside your window. What would you like to see? Imagine all the things that could be done to beautify your property. At Michael Labriola, we've led the field over 35 years. Our expert staff brings all their best to give you what you need.
For more than 40 years, Michael Labriola Incorporated has provided complete landscape construction and site development services that will add beauty, enjoyment, and value to your property. Want to make some changes to your landscape this spring? Maybe extending your living space to the outdoors with a functional outdoor kitchen or adding a patio or walkway? Michael Labriola Incorporated can evaluate your property and offer creative ideas. 914-273-6530. Commercial properties always welcome. Learn more at michaellabriolainc.com.
Michael Labriola, our last name is the first name in landscapes.
Pasquale Ristorante. Pasquale Ristorante. Pasquale Ristorante. Pasquale Ristorante. From the heart of Italy.
Pasquale Ristorante is the perfect dining experience. Your favorite Italian comfort food, plus the comforts of home away from home. Pasquale Ristorante has been treating you like family for nearly 20 years. And if you need catering, Pasquale will take care of it. Pasquale Ristorante, bringing family, friends, and food together.
Pasquale Ristorante treats you just like family. Pasquale Ristorante, an Italian specialty.
Pasquale Ristorante, 2 Putnam Avenue in Port Chester.
Check out the upcoming events tab on FairfieldCountyTalkRadio.com for where we'll be next. Let us know how we can help your next event. Call 1-866-SHARK-99.
And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. We are chatting with State Senator Will Haskell, who is very involved in everything going on right now in Hartford because this is budget season and everything is important. So just to continue the conversation about the vaccinations, there's a proposal in front of you or in front of the legislature to eliminate the religious exemption. What committee is that heard in and what are the chances of that coming to a full vote?
Now, yesterday there was a hearing in the Public Health Committee, but given the surprising nature of the revelation from the Department of Public Health, there actually wasn't a bill in the start of the legislative session. I mentioned earlier that we have 2 weeks to propose bills, but we didn't know that there were 108 schools where the immunization rate fell below the recommended 95% across Connecticut. So I'm sure would have brought up a bill if we had known, but there wasn't a bill at the time.
That means what happens?
We're likely going to do something called an emergency certification, meaning that there's going to be, in response to unpredictable circumstances or unforeseen data.
Outbreak of measles.
That's
too.
Exactly right. We are likely going to bring a new bill to the Senate and to the floor. It won't go through the full committee hearing process, but it was important that we had a public hearing where there was an opportunity, by the way, for dozens. And I should... these folks are worth mentioning. Dozens of parents who came to testify against getting rid of that religious exemption, who feel very strongly that that vaccines are harming their children. Now, the data.
By the way, you realize that it's not really a religious argument they're making.
No, it's not.
They're making a medical argument. They really believe that medically it's unsafe. So if they can show the data that shows it's unsafe for their kid, then theoretically they could get a medical exemption. They're not arguing that God doesn't want them to vaccinate.
No, that's exactly right. And because we're on the radio, and I'm sure people are listening, it's important to be very clear that the data pretty explicitly shows, and the consensus of the medical community is that vaccines work. Vaccines keep your children safe. You know, when I, it's important to me when I go to the doctor that that person have a medical degree. And the same is important to me when I listen to folks about vaccines.
Sure.
When the doctors come and testify emphatically that vaccines are responsible for eliminating polio, that they're one of the greatest public health tools that we've seen
ever
in the 20th and 21st century, that they've saved more lives, I think that that we ought to listen. And I grew up lucky enough to not worry when I walked into the classroom that I might get polio from one of my classmates. That's a privilege that my grandparents didn't have. I want to be able to pass on that privilege to the next generation. And it's especially important that we're talking about this on Fairfield County Radio, because Fairfield County is quite close to New York. And it's in New York, specifically in Brooklyn, that we see this outbreak.
And Rockland County.
That's exactly right.
I
so
know.
Given the folks who might cross into New York every day to work and come back home at night, see their kids at home, I think it's very, very important in this part of the state that we talk about how to protect our own schools.
The conversation about vaccinations to me is a very important one altogether. But getting back to this, I had a, my daughter had a friend, now she's now 26, so 20 years ago, who was a six-year-old in the Westport Public Schools. And the mother told me that she, and her daughter had a severe case of autism, you know, mute autism. And it was a little girl, and the mother told me that she was convinced that a vaccine, first I'd ever heard of this 20 years ago, that a vaccine gave it to her daughter because she was convinced that before her daughter had the vaccine, she was a normal, thriving infant, and that afterwards she got a fever and sick and never came out of this state of being. Doctors will say that it is an unfortunate coincidence that autism tends to come on as an onset at the very same time that the MMR vaccine is given. One of the ways that has been suggested to assuage concerns of parents is, number one, to delay the giving of vaccine if your child has any kind of cold, which makes perfect medical sense, right? And also to separate the MMR into an M, an M, and an R over time if you think your own child's immune system might be overwhelmed by giving the MMR all at once. And I think that these are reasonable accommodations to people who have medically based, even superstitiously medically based fears. But nowhere in this conversation is anybody saying my faith prevents me from having a vaccine. Even the people that came to testify, they're not saying their religious faith prevents it, are they?
A small number are, but there are numerous religious leaders across Connecticut who are emphatically urging their followers, their congregants, to vaccinate their children. And again, it's not my job to play theologian, but the arguments that I hear from my constituents, and I've met with so many of them who are concerned about vaccines, it is a fear argument. It is not a religious argument. And I think that that... that bears repeating. It's a really important point. But to your point about there are certain medical reasons that some children shouldn't be vaccinated. If your immune system is compromised, I believe strongly in a medical exemption. Nobody's trying to get rid of that.
Correct.
And I would actually like to strengthen it. I want to make sure that parents feel that it is that their doctors will listen to them if they're concerned that their child isn't doesn't have a strong enough immune system to
on an individual basis.
Absolutely.
Totally.
But couching that in a supposed religious exemption is frankly disrespectful to the notion of religious liberty, which I think is really actually quite important.
So, Senator Will Haskell, so you know what else I saw that was raised in this session? It sort of triggered an eyebrow, raised eyebrow with me, is that there is concern among some legislators that the federal government has been too heavy-handed with respect to deportation proceedings. And specifically, that the laws with respect to criminal penalties for misdemeanors should be made to be 364 days instead of 365 days to serve, because the meaning of that is if a sentence is less than 1 year, then somehow that will not come on the radar of ICE, and the people will not then be likely to be deported.
That it is really important legislation, and it's been a priority among many of my colleagues in regard to criminal justice reform. It's not something that I've worked extensively on, although I did already vote for it once in the Judiciary Committee, and I hope to vote again for it soon.
You're on the Judiciary Committee?
I am, yeah.
That's cool.
I hope to vote again for it soon on the Senate floor because, look, the difference between 365 days and 364 days may not mean a lot to you and me, but to somebody who's arrested for a misdemeanor,
yes,
it means the world, because under a 365-day sentence, the federal government can come in and initiate deportation proceedings against them. And I just do not believe that we should be deporting folks for misdemeanors. It is going to have a chilling effect on the entirety of our criminal justice system. If somebody is worried about calling 911 in a community because the person who's arrested for some misdemeanor crime might be deported, they're going to stop engaging with law enforcement, stop using the tools available to them to enshrine public safety. We ought to be giving law enforcement the tools to really work collaboratively with communities, to engage in community policing, not to be a de facto ICE force in Connecticut communities.
How does Connecticut law enforcement feel about this kind of a bill?
You know, I haven't heard much testimony from law enforcement officers that they feel that extra day is tremendously important in punishing
somebody.
Well,
but how do they feel generally speaking about cooperating with ICE? Because I know there's a patchwork. There's a lot of different opinions among law enforcement on this.
There are a lot of different opinions, and I wouldn't presume to speak for all the police chiefs out there who have come to testify. But the majority of police chiefs have their hands full. Whether it's a town like Wilton, where they're trying to make sure that people drive safely, that there isn't a lot of drunk driving, or whether it's a police chief in Bridgeport or Hartford who's dealing often with more serious crimes with gun violence, they have a lot on their plate. And I think the last thing they need to be worried about is deporting folks who have been arrested for misdemeanor crimes in our community. It's not fair to the families that they're separating. It's also not the fundamental job of a local police force. I've also heard a lot from folks who are concerned about the increasing ICE presence, and I think that you'll appreciate this given the other hat that you wear as a judge, in our criminal justice system and in the courts themselves. You know, there have been instances in Connecticut of ICE officials showing up at courthouses. Now, if you're afraid to go to a courthouse, whether it's to pay your parking ticket, whether it's to file a claim against somebody, whether it's to be a witness, if you're afraid to show up in court because you might be deported by somebody who's sitting in the audience, then you're going to stop engaging with the criminal justice system. If you're a victim, you might not come forward for fear of being deported. It is going to have a chilling effect on our ability to provide public safety for all. And I'm very concerned that ICE officials are showing up more and more inside courthouses. Chase Rogers, the former Chief Justice, was very clear. She issued a directive that ICE officials were not welcome in Connecticut courthouses. But that directive hasn't always been followed.
And now she's former.
That's exactly right.
So now we've got a new Chief Justice Robinson, and he may have to, if he believes in that policy, he may have to issue his own sort of proclamation on that.
You know, I talked a lot during the campaign about the fact that state government has to be the first line of defense against what's happening in Washington. Democrats or Republicans, in diners like this or at front doors, I heard from people that they're concerned with what they see on TV, that that they don't recognize the values of the Trump administration. And we see, this is, by the way, just as true of those liberal Democrats as those old school George H.W. Bush conservatives. They don't recognize the value, the utility, or the compassion in rapidly increasing deportation proceedings in Connecticut. This is one of so many areas where Connecticut is stepping up to the plate, where the state government is serving as that first line of defense for those who live in Connecticut and saying, you know what, not here. We are going to amend our state laws so that we can protect individuals. 364 days, 365 days may not seem like a lot, but it is a world of difference to a family who might be separated.
Do you think it will be coming to a vote?
I think so.
Okay. And finally, just in the last few minutes that we have, we're chatting with Senator Will Haskell. Talk to me about tolls. You have been on the campaign trail, I think, supporting them. I am, you know, not on the campaign trail, and I am not supporting them. I am driving a lot during the day, and I don't want to have to pay them. But I understand there's a lot of bargaining going on now. The Hartford Courant yesterday said that Ned Lamont, the Governor Lamont, is talking about doing something with the gasoline tax, of which we have two. There was word earlier in the week that perhaps a compromise might be not on the merit, but just on 95. Tell us what's happening.
Sure. Thank you for bringing this up. You saved the best for last. So I did run on tolls. You know, we're the only state along the Eastern Seaboard that doesn't ask out-of-state drivers or trucking companies to contribute to the roads as they drive through Connecticut.
The truckers disagree. They say they pay big fees.
$18 million, which is an important fee, but it pales in comparison to the wear and tear the trucks have on our streets, far more than the average car. When a truck takes I-95, it has a severe grinding effect on our infrastructure. That's why we see over 300 bridges in Connecticut that are structurally deficient. We don't have a strong rail system through this state, so all of our goods are moved by really heavy trucks, and I think they ought to pay their fair share. So we are engaged in a healthy debate on tolls, I would say, in the state capitol, and there's all sorts of sweeteners being put in, because right now it doesn't seem that they have the votes to pass it. So I was actually reasonably excited to see that the governor is interested in reducing the gas tax. I think that's going to make it a little bit more affordable for people to get to and from work. I was also excited to see that in the most recent toll bill, we're going to fully fund Connecticut Welcome Center so that they can be fully operational. As somebody who does a lot of driving myself, I can't stand driving by a Connecticut Welcome Center that's closed. I think that's a bad image for our state. And given that we are a geographic hotspot between Boston and New York, it's a missed opportunity for tax revenue from tourists. And then there was a compromise suggested that I didn't like very much, and that's to put tolls only on 95 and not the merit.
Well, you didn't like that?
Oh, I can't imagine what that would do to the merit. Can you imagine how many people...
You already can't go on it.
Right, and how many people would just hop off 95 onto the merit? Because in our community, 95 and the merit run essentially alongside one another, it would be a real mistake to put tolls on one and not the other, diverting all the traffic onto the other highway that likely can't support it. Already is packed. Already is congested, and to your point. So what we're looking at right now is 4.4 cents per mile. It's going to raise around $800 million. Well, 4.4 cents per mile is actually smack dab in the middle of the other states on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, but it comes to about $700 a year for my commute.
Here's what... I'm sympathetic to that, but here's the message that I just want
to... And my commute is 22 miles each way.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Well, here's the message I want to leave you with. Every Democrat, every Republican, every independent, everybody I've met, whether it's on the campaign trail in Hartford, believes that we need to invest in our infrastructure. The train today is slower than it was in 1950. We've got roads and bridges that are crumbling. Nobody's happy with the status quo. We all agree that we need an investment. The question is, should that investment be funded by a user fee charged to those on our roads?
Which is, in my view, very regressive.
Well, there's a way to do it, I think, that's smart, that gives a tax rebate to low-income folks, that offers a 30% discount for Connecticut drivers, a 20% discount if you're a frequent flyer. There's a way to raise around $800 million where 40% of it comes from out of state. Or there's the plan that we see on the other side of the aisle, and that's to enter into millions of dollars of bonding, which is essentially a tax on the next generation. And I'll just close by saying, as the youngest member of the General Assembly, I can't stomach a continuation of what we've done for decades, which is send the bill with interest onto your kids and to your grandkids.
Senator Will Haskell, I'm letting you have the last word on this. And I thank you very much for coming in this morning. Thank you for being part of the Lisa Wexler Show. Thank you for being so involved and interested in every person's point of view who comes up to Hartford. You already are getting a reputation as somebody who listens, as somebody whose door is open, and somebody who gets himself educated on the issues. So as your constituent, I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming in today. You're listening to the Lisa Wexler Show. Thanks for joining us this morning.
From Greenwich to Danbury, Wilton to Westport, Fairfield County Talk Radio is here to help serve the community.